excited to talk about a topic that might be a little bit uncomfortable. We're going to be talking about purity and integrity when it is very bad to be a little good. Now, I don't want to make any assumptions that aren't founded, but I feel comfortable making this assumption. Most of us feel pretty negatively towards behavior we consider hypocritical and towards people who we might label hypocrites. And we also feel very concerned in and of ourselves, and when we feel like we're not being genuine, when we feel like we might be rightly called hypocritical. Now, my question for you is why? Right? Why is it that we find hypocrisy to be so bad? Because there's another way that you can think about it, right? Which I'm only mentioning to be sort of a hypocrite's advocate. I don't actually feel this way, but there's one way to think about this, which is, well, if somebody acts a certain way in one context well, and then acts negatively in another context poorly, why do we look at that person as a hypocrite? And when we could think of them as being kind of half good, right? They're not always honest, but they're honest 20% of the time, right? Why is it that instead of looking at sort of segmenting that person's behavior and letting the good remain good and the bad remain bad, why don't we lump it all together into this state, right, that we are so, so hateful of, right, the state of hypocrisy? And I think we actually are quite justified in our distaste for hypocrisy or for people that seem to be one way and actually are another. But I think it's really helpful for us to probe exactly where this feeling comes from and what justifies it. Because when it's a very clear, you know, terrible hypocrisy situation, that's very clean and cut. And we can see, right, exactly what's going on. We can feel it. But if we have a good sense of the components of hypocrisy, the small problems with hypocrisy that make it so bad, then when we're in a situation where we haven't quite hit the threshold of total hypocrite, but are doing something that has some of these components that make this behavior or make this character trait distasteful, we'll be more sensitive to it. Right? So the reason why we want to probe why this is problematic is so that we can sense it even in its smaller and harder to detect forms. Okay. Yes. There are more source sheets, and somebody will bring you one. Okay, good question. Yeah, whoever doesn't have a source sheet, just keep your hand raised and Revetan or Ariel will make sure that you get one. Okay. Yeah, keep your hand up. There's more available. Okay. Now that I know that everybody has a source sheet, we're going to start with the first text, Mishnat Rabbi Eliezer. And this text starts with a quote from Tehillim, Torat Hashem Tamima, the Torah of God is perfect. Seems like a pretty innocuous statement, but the Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer says, well, actually, sometimes the Torah is more perfect and sometimes it's less perfect. Okay? So we got to find out, when is it perfect? It's perfect when a person learns and does. Because whoever learns and does not do, that person profanes God's name. For it is a mitzvah to lend with interest, it's a mitzvah not to lend with interest. That's an important distinction, right? And he lends with interest. It's a mitzvah not to steal, and he steals. It's a mitzvah not to cause to pass, and he passes. And so it says, the wisdom of the poor is disgraced. So far, so good. We don't want to have someone who really understands the Torah and doesn't abide by the Torah's dictums. And so it says, v'chokhmat hamizkeim b'ziyah, the wisdom of the poor is disgraced. Now, we know all sorts of poor rabbis who aren't disgraced, right? So this can't possibly be referring to people who are poor in financial means. There has to be something else about them that makes them disgraced. So the text continues, and were Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues wealthy? Right? Does it actually matter whether or not you're rich or poor? So why are we talking about the wisdom of the poor specifically being disgraced? Rather, this is one who is poor in deeds, for he learns and doesn't do. Right? So the person who otherwise would have been respected, he would have been considered the chacham. Now he is going to be disgraced because of the deeds that he should be doing and should not and is not doing. Therefore, the aron was covered in gold inside and out. If I wanted to make something decorative and beautiful, and I wanted to save some money, right, I wouldn't line the inside of my closet with gold. I would just put gold on the outside. But the aron itself is gold on the inside and on the outside. And what does the aron carry? The most important thing that the aron carries is the luchot, right, is the text, are the stones, right, that have the Torah written on them. So the aron becomes a kind of metaphor for a Talmid Chacham, who is someone who also walks around with the Torah inside them. Right, so why does the aron, which represents the Talmid Chacham, need to be gold both on the inside and on the outside? It's to tell you that Torah scholars need to have their insides match their outsides. Right, and when we think of hypocrites, we often think about someone who appears to be good on the outside and actually is kind of rotten on the inside. It's interesting that Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer, their first hypocrite that they're putting under the lens, is actually someone who's a Talmid Chacham, who therefore is gold on the inside because they're spending all of their time really figuring out what the right thing is to do, really understanding the Torah. They've got the Torah all inside, but on the outside, they've actually don't have a lot to show for it. So in order to be not hypocritical, in order to be the aron, you have to be both gold on the inside and gold on the outside. My question for you is this, before we finish the text, why is it so important to say this about a Talmid Chacham? Why is it that the Torah scholar is the one that we have to drill down on, that he has to be really, really good, both on the inside and the outside? Why don't we talk about a regular person first? Why are we going for the Torah scholar? Why are they more important in this conversation? Yeah. Okay, good, right? So one reason why we would want to focus on them is that they teach by doing. So whatever the Torah scholar does kind of goes, and so we have to be careful to make sure that this person is doing like they know. Because I don't have access to what you know. I can't see what you know, but I can see what you do. Good, but why is a Talmid Chacham who is not Tohu Kevaroh, who does not have gold on the inside and the outside, why is that person so dangerous? Yeah. When an unlettered person, when somebody who hasn't studied the Torah does something wrong, what do we say? Ugh, that person should not have done that bad thing. And we blame that person. When a Torah scholar does something wrong and they behave in a way that we find disgusting, we don't say, wow, Rabbi so-and-so, she's really got a problem. What do we say? We say the Torah. If this is what the Torah makes, then I don't want to have anything to do with it. Right? So the problem with being a Torah scholar who doesn't behave well is that your behavior ends up casting aspersions on the Torah. And this is what I want to start drilling down on. It would be better for this Torah scholar to not have learned any Torah if they were going to behave this way. We don't say, oh, well, at least they're very well educated. Too bad they don't behave well. Right? What we say is that their education, their access to the Torah actually makes their bad behavior worse. The fact that they know what they should be doing and still do the wrong thing makes their behavior worse because it doesn't only testify about them, it testifies about the Torah. And I actually want to skip down to Beit HaRabbah. Don't worry, we'll get to the end of Mishnah Rabbi Eliezer, where Rabbi Yochanan has generally has a very succinct and very sharp way of putting things. And I think it's worthwhile to see how Rabbi Yochanan feels about this. Rabbi Yochanan says, Halameid shelo la'asot, someone who learns in order not to do, right? Someone who plans to like coat their insides with gold but could not care less about how terrible their outsides look. What do we say about them? It would have been better for his placenta to have covered his face and he not have emerged into the air of the world. Better for this person not to have been successfully born. So dangerous, so terrible is somebody who learns and learns and learns and then holds it inside and doesn't allow it to come out and be gold on the outside. Fighting words. Rabbi Yochanan is not joking. Okay. I want to go back to the previous text of Mishnat Rabbi Eliezer, because we know that we have to have gold on the inside and we have to have gold on the outside. So why don't we just make a box that's entirely made out of gold? Solve my problem. The inside will be the outside because there is only one material. Why do I need to have a box of gold inside a box of wood inside a box of gold? I'm not going to be saving money on the gold. At least let me save a little money on the wood, right? So why do I need to have this wooden box? If so, why does there need to be wood inside? We're five lines down in the first text, five lines from the end of the first text. If it weren't for the wood, there would be no structure for the gold. Similarly, if it were not for the Yetzer Hara, if it were not for the evil inclination, there would be no structure for the tzaddik. Okay. So first half of the text, we talk about how bad it is to be coated with gold. And now, here we are at the end of the text, praising the Yetzer Hara, praising this evil inclination, because it provides some structure for the gold, provides a home for the tzaddik. What do we think is happening here? What is the value of the wood here? Yes. Great. I'm just going to repeat that statement because it's hard to hear in here. She said, because we know what's good from the breach, right? That sometimes good and bad, I'm able to assess good and bad from the comparison between the two. If I didn't have any sense of, I want to do this, but it's bad, I wouldn't necessarily understand, right, what it means to become good. And there's something about the Torah scholar's ability, or really anybody's, right, ability to want to do bad and push against it that creates a structure. It makes your spine stand up straight when you feel the force of something that you should do or should not do, and you're caught in between, and it forces you to choose the sort of middle and upright path. Yes, Fanny.
It brings me to think about Or HaKoshech, right? Is there light in itself, or is there just, you know, dark sense? So is there gold without wood?
Beautiful, right? The gold would just crumble, right? It actually needs to have something that it's being pushed against, that it's being contrasted with in order for it to be shiny, in order for it to be beautiful. There's this amazing Shel Silverstein poem where somebody plants like a diamond and then they grow a tree that, you know, gives off emeralds and rubies, and then all the farmer wants after he's surrounded by all this gold and jewels, he just wants a peach, right? He just wants a real peach. Right, so I think that's part of what's going on here. You actually don't know what the absolute value is. You need to have something to compare it to. Yes?
Even though it's highly valued, wood is something of a much more complex sense of work, but it's stable. Think of it as our practical interaction with the world. What good is ideal?
Right, so what this comment is pointing us to is that the question is actually not such a great question. Of course you need to have the wooden box. If you didn't have the wooden box, you wouldn't actually be able to have a structure for the gold because it would just sort of crumble, right? So the wood actually, even though it's cheap, it's sturdy, right? And so the gold and the wood actually support one another, right? The gold makes the wood beautiful and the wood makes the gold stable. Okay, but I wanna push ahead. I want to get at why it's so bad to be a little good. And unfortunately, you want to continue with the image of Rabbi Yochanan brought up of children who are almost born, but do not quite make it into the world. And our first example, right, of someone who deliberately chose, right, to kill a baby rather than have them live in the world is Paro. In his decree that we are going to kill all the male babies, but the female babies, no problem, they can live. I wanted to start with Pharaoh because I like that he's a kind of comically diabolical, terrible figure. Right, so first we're going to talk about someone who we're pretty confident that we are not like. Like, I'm not the best person in the world, but I've never commanded an entire people's, you know, babies to be slaughtered. So when I compare myself to Pharaoh, I feel pretty good. As we continue on, we're going to see the ways in which maybe we all have a little bit of Pharaoh inside us, but first we're going to start where it's more comfortable, where he's like this, and we are not like that. Okay, so we're going to start with Paro. We're going to start with the Or HaChaim. The Or HaChaim is very good at asking lots and lots of questions, and then answering all of them in one fell swoop. So we're going to go through the questions because it's part of his artistry. If you're not able to hold on to all the different details of all the questions, that's okay. I promise you that his resolution is still going to be extremely valuable. So we're starting with Vayomer. Paro says to these midwives, "B'yaledchen et ha'ivriyo, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth, u'ri'itan al havnayim, and you're going to see on the birthing stool, im benhu v'hamiten otel, if the child is male, then you are going to put the child to death. V'im bahi v'chaya, but if it's a female child, she can live." That's Paro's decree. You might say to yourself, yeah, I understand exactly what he's saying. Turns out you don't. We have five really important questions to ask about this. Okay, question number one. It needs to be known, what was the purpose of this proof? Why did Paro say, oh, when you see on the birthing stool that the child is male, then you'll kill him? Well, does it matter how I found out whether the child was male? Why do I need to know that it's happening on the birthing stool? He should have said, here's a great rephrasing of what Pharaoh should have said. If it is a male, kill it. I don't need all the details about how you're going to find out how he's male. If he's male, kill him. And further, where we also have this midrashic tradition, according to the words of our teachers who said he gave them a sign, the rabbis also wanted to know why Pharaoh made this comment about the birthing stool. And they said, well, oh, actually, Pharaoh was giving them a little obstetrical advice, right, and telling them, here's how you'll know whether the baby is male or female. I do not think this is medically accurate, just for the record. Okay, a male will be facing down, and a female will be facing up, right? So you'll know, even before you get to the baby's genitals, you'll know from the point of the crowning of the head whether or not the child is male. And he says, I didn't know why these signs were necessary. We generally assign sex at birth based on the genitals, not based on whether the head is facing up or facing down. It's a good question. Okay, that's question number one. Question number two. Also, it needs to be known why Paro didn't decree against all of them. This is the question that I like. You're killing babies, you might as well go for it, if you're that bad. Oh, thank you so much for the dispensation for the female babies. Thanks, but no thanks, right? Why is Paro, who's not a very nice guy, deciding that he's going to have quote-unquote mercy on these female babies? It needs to be known why Paro didn't decree against all of them. It can't be believed that he did this through his attribute of mercy so that there would be some remnant in the land. Because it's impossible that Paro's doing this because he feels bad. Because he doesn't want to get rid of all the Jews. No, 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 he wants to get rid of all the Jews. So there needs to be another reason why he's allowing the female children to live. For his root is a root of cruelty. We know Paro. He is a comically horrible villain. He is not letting the female babies live because he likes female babies. He's not that nice. Further, it is difficult that he said, and you should kill him, with an added vav. I would say this is the question that bothers me the least. If there's a vav, okay, I'm not gonna lose sleep on it, but the Or HaChaim is going to lose sleep. If you wanna get a sense of the Or HaChaim's commentary, he has an explanation for every single time the Torah says, lamor, right? Saying. God said to Moses, saying. God said to Moses, saying. God said to Moses, saying. Every single time it says saying is a different interpretation for why. So he's very bothered by this vav. I don't necessarily feel like I need to lose sleep over this vav. But anyway, it's difficult that he said, and you should kill him. With an added vav, when there was no act before the matter. Right, if I come up to you and I start my instruction, it's odd for me to start my instruction with and, because it makes it seem like I'm continuing an instruction that I've already begun. But this is the first thing that I'm saying to you. Further, why did he have to say, if it is a girl, she will live? Process of elimination. Okay, if I only tell you to kill the male babies, guess who's gonna be left? The female babies. Since Paro only decreed against the males, obviously the midwives, right, they would have taken it upon themselves to try to uproot everyone. Lakor et akol. So here are my questions. What is the deal with this sign? Why do I need a sign? I already have a sign. They're called genitals. Why do I care that the baby's facing up or down? My other question is, don't I know by process of elimination that he's allowing the female children to live? And also, why is he allowing the female children to live? That doesn't seem very Paro-esque. That seems kind of merciful, and that's not Paro's deal. Mercy isn't one of his top attributes. Right? And then the last question is, what's the and for? What is this a continuation of what he's trying to do? Okay, I'm excited for us to get to some answers. Indeed, this evil man, that is Paro, acted cleverly so that his plan would be successful. Because what woman would make herself available to a midwife who will kill her children? Okay? Women talk. And if everybody who invites midwife Shifra to her house ends up with a dead baby, midwife Shifra is not going to be getting a lot of business anymore. We would figure out another way, because this is clearly not an effective way for us to have children. Therefore, he acted cleverly and said that they should behave in this way and act in secret, so that the birthing mothers wouldn't sense what was happening. Yeah, they don't realize that Shifra and Pua, or whatever who these midwives would have been, are killing the babies. They have no idea. And how do they not know? How do they not sense this pattern? Well, they would act in secret, so the birthing mothers wouldn't sense what was happening. For before the sex of the baby was known, the midwives would see from the birthing stool. If it was a boy, they would kill him and say that he had been born dead. And they wouldn't wait until he came out crying. So the birthing mothers didn't know that the midwives were killing the children. The birthing mothers thought that they were giving birth to stillborns. They never heard the baby cry. And so therefore, right, and this is where the insidiousness really comes in, they think it's them, right? They think that there's something wrong with their pregnancy. They think that they're the problem, that they're giving birth to dead children. They don't realize that there's an outside factor that is interfering in the birth process. And they wouldn't wait until he came out crying. Rather, when they were still on the birthing stool, before the baby emerged into the world, they, that is the midwives, would see if it was male. But how did they know this? How were they able to tell that the baby was male before the baby emerged from the birth canal? That's what the rabbis were referring to when they said that he, that is Paro, gave them a sign. And that's why it says, and you should kill, with a vav. Because the first command was to determine if it was male before it emerged into the world and made noise. And the second was that you should kill him as he emerges from his mother's belly. So Paro has two very specific instructions. The first is, make sure you figure out the sex of the baby before the mother has a sense of that her baby is viable, and then kill it before she knows. And it says, if it's a female, because he was also being intentional in this, so that through this, the birthing mothers wouldn't notice, since they would see that occasionally their children would remain alive. And they wouldn't mistrust the midwives, since they were only killing the males and not the females. And it's possible that he never told them that they had a male baby. Right? The midwife wouldn't say, oh, the baby that was stillborn is a male, they would just say, I'm sorry, the baby didn't make it. Sex unspecified. They would say that it was born dead, and in that way, it would negate the suspicion. Okay. So Paro is not keeping the female babies alive because he likes the female babies and he wants them to survive and thrive. It's true that he's allowing these babies to live, but the only reason why he's allowing these babies to live is that it's a cover for his plan. If he didn't allow the female babies to live, he would not be able to successfully kill the male babies because the Jewish women would pick up on this and would stop hiring the midwives. I want to probe into why this is so terrible, and then I want to take some more comments. Right, the sophistication here, the fact that Paro is being clever, is part of what makes this so cruel. We can understand face-to-face violence and sort of know how to avoid it, but because Paro is being so clever, we don't realize that we're endangering ourselves, and Paro's sophistication ends up implicating these Israelite women in the death of their own children because they don't have the access to knowing that they're setting themselves up for danger. Paro is not enabling them to understand what they're doing. They're not able to make informed choices. He's tricking them, and their trickery, and that trickery makes them, in some ways, not in a fault way, not in a blame way, but makes them in some ways complicit. They're being forced to participate in a system that is systematically killing their children. There's a really frustrating technical monetary law that distinguishes between robbery and theft. If I steal something from you in broad daylight, it's a carjacking, some sort of open robbery, then the penalty is that I have to pay back the object itself. But if I steal something from you, if I embezzle from your bank account, right, then what I have to pay you is double. And the rabbis ask a very important question. What, isn't armed robbery way worse than embezzling? Why do I have to pay more for embezzling for Geneva than I do for outright robbery for Gezel? And the answer that the rabbis give is when you are robbing in broad daylight, you're just as afraid of God as you are of man. In the sense that you're not really afraid of either of them. You see what you want, you grab your knife, and you take it. So you're not a hero, but at least you're keeping God and human beings on the same level. But when you're a thief, when you're an embezzler, you're afraid of what people are going to think, but you're not afraid of what God can think, because you know that God can see you and you don't care about that. Right? And I think that part of what's going on underneath this explanation is something along the lines of what we're talking about here. I can get an alarm system, I can get armor, I can do something about a crime that I know is going to happen. When there's a clear and present danger, I can emotionally or physically or whatever prepare myself from it. If I see a robber coming to me, I can run away. If somebody's breaking into my house in the middle of the night, I'm just sleeping there. And I don't have the sense of security. I don't have the ability to be able to maneuver, right, in a way that's going to be efficacious for me. So the theft is psychologically worse because there is nothing that I can do about it. And the knowledge of it, right, pervades my way of being in the world in a way that's much more sinister, right, than one freak robbery that I'm fairly confident isn't going to happen again. Okay, I'm going to take some comments and some questions. Yes, in the back. Eventually this would be found out. This delays the finding out. I think that what he's noting is I'm much more likely to think that it's sort of isolated in my house if I've had a successful female birth. So I'm not going to be talking to the other mothers about what happened. If I lost the pregnancy, I'm just sort of gonna keep it to myself. It's going to take a long time before people realize, oh, the only babies in this entire cohort have all been born female. So you're right, eventually it would still be found out, but the immediate pressure of, I gotta tell my friends, Shifra and Pooh are really dangerous, that wouldn't happen. Yeah. Anne. So my point is not about how good Paro's plan was. Maybe even with this plan, it wasn't a good plan and it would have been found out. Right? The point of this, right, is to get you to understand that what seems to be positive in the plan, what seems to be merciful in the merciful component itself is the root of the evil. The plan would be less evil. Not only because it would be less successful, but because it would be less destabilizing to the people who were under this realm if it were open, right? If there weren't that merciful component. So the merciful component has the effect of making the evil worse. Yes. Exactly, right? And I think the element of trust is so important because it also leads you to blame yourself. Why was I so dumb? Why didn't I check Angie's List to know that this was not a good midwife, right? Why didn't I consult? Why did I just accept the first midwife who came, right? When it becomes about trust and when you have that small amount of agency, that creates a little opening for you to blame yourself. Why didn't I lock up my valuables better? But if somebody just came over to you with a gun and robbed you, you wouldn't blame yourself. You would just blame them, right? And this gets back to what we were talking about earlier about the Torah, right? The problem with the Talmid Chacham who doesn't do right is that his poor behavior casts aspersions on the Torah. The problem here with Paro is that the way that he's constructing his bad behavior, it's making you doubt yourself. It's making you cast aspersions on your own behavior. You don't just say, oh, Paro's evil. You say, Paro outsmarted me. I should have seen this coming. I should have noticed that there haven't been a lot of circumcisions, even though there have been a lot of births. I should have noticed that, and I didn't. Right? And it creates, this is the part that I actually think is the worst. It creates space for you to blame yourself, even though you're entirely blameless.
Yes, three.
So I'm just going to repeat Serene's comment in case people didn't hear. Serene said, also, it's not only the person themselves, right, who loses their agency or actually starts to feel more complicit, also other people around. If I see a crime happening, I might be able to step in and stop it, or I might be able to support the person after the fact. If I don't know that something's happening, if something's happening underneath the surface, it deprives me also as a bystander of that agency and my ability to help and make things better. Paro's bad. We're going to move on to a circumstance which is a little bit closer to home. We're gonna keep on going until we're talking about us. Warning, it's eventually going to be about us. Okay. So we're going a little bit back in time to the Kliyakar of Shlomo Ephraim Lunchitz, who has his own version of Paro's problem. But here, it's less monstrous. It's much more pedestrian. Here he's going to be talking about false weights and measures. Who hasn't shaved a little bit off their weight and measure? Who hasn't cheated a little bit on their taxes? Maybe I rounded up and I should have rounded down. Right? This is a little bit closer to where we are. His opening is, I would say, even more technical than the Or HaChaim's. So again, bear with me. I feel like compelled to do justice by these texts, and I also feel like it's okay if you need to check out for a minute while we go through the really technical pieces. Lo yalecha b'kischa even ve'even gedola u'katana. Do not have in your pocket two different stones, one that's big and one that's small. Right, so the plain sense of this verse is, your measures should be accurate. Everybody should know that when you weigh them at a pound, what they're getting is a pound. Okay. But again, the Kli Yakar does not think that it's so obvious what's going on in this verse. One has to examine. If the explanation is larger than is appropriate and smaller than appropriate, and they are both false. You know what? I'm going to do you a favor. I think we're going to skip this really technical piece. I'm going to summarize it for you, and I promise you that my summary is accurate, and on your own time, you will be able to go through this because I'm getting exhausted just thinking about it. So essentially, the Kli Yakar says, it's impossible that we're talking about both of these weights being dishonest. Because of the way that the verse is structured, if both of the weights are dishonest, then I would just say, have honest weights. Why would I have to talk about having an honest weight and a complete weight? So I'm not talking about two weights that are dishonest. And through a process of more derivation, he figures out that what's going on here is that one of the weights is honest and the other weight is dishonest. And that you are being chastised not only for your honest weight, but also for your honest weight. Okay? So we're gonna pick up a little bit in the middle. Where it says, so why does it say that there shouldn't be a heavy weight in your pocket? I would say that's about a little less than a third of the way down in the English on page number 3. It's right before the bold, those who do these are detestable to God. Everybody with me? Third of the way down? Okay, you're welcome for sparing you on that technical piece. Okay. So why does it say that there shouldn't be a heavy weight in your pocket? Why not have an honest weight? And further, when it says that those who do these are detestable to God, all who do injustice, why does it need two? Why do I have to say in multiple everyone who does these? Why don't I just say, well, everyone who does injustice, they're bad news? And all who do injustice makes it sound like not anyone who does either of these is doing injustice. And this needs to be understood. Okay. The explanation of this matter is along the lines of what Shlomo, or King Solomon, said in Sefer Mishlei in the book of Proverbs, Even the Even, Eifa the Eifa, Tuavat Adonai. A weight and a weight, a measure and a measure, are alike, both detested by God. If they are both false, then why does the verse say that they are alike, both detested? Of course they're both detested. They're both false weights. God's not going to say, well, this false weight, I don't like this false weight. But the other false weight is great. Right? God doesn't like cheating. So why would God say both of them alike are despised? God would have just said, don't have a false weight. For from where would it come to distinguish between them? What then is the function of the term alike? Rather, it must be that the verse is speaking about one which is false and one which is true. And God even hates the true weight. And it indicates that even the honest weight is called detested because it is the honest weight which causes him to weigh with the false one. Okay? The reason why the honest weight is a problem is the honest weight is my cover. It's what enables me to cheat my customers. And then it goes through a very good plan. If anybody's interested in cheating your customers, here is a step-by-step proposal. Here's what you do. For if he did not have the honest weight, he would be afraid to weigh for everyone with the small false one. For when all of the customers get home, they will find that they got a smaller amount. And the cry of the many against him will come to the court saying, he weighed out less for all of us. If you have someone who's consistently giving you less than you expect, you go home and you measure and it turns out it's not a pound, everybody's gonna go back and demand their money. And every single person is going to say to, you know, their friend, don't buy from that spice seller, he's cheating you. He's only giving you 7/8 of the pound. So that's not a good plan. You can't just cheat everybody because you're gonna be found out immediately. Can't do that. Here's what you do instead. Okay, what could he say, right? So when everybody comes and they say, ah, we don't have our full weight, what could he say? Maybe it diminished in your home. So he's going to say, well, actually something magical happened from the store to your house, and that's when your weight became less. It's impossible. That is not realistic. So what does he do? He goes and he weighs out for some of them using the small, diminished weight, and for some of them with the large and honest weight. And to those who were weighed out a diminished amount, he can claim in court, I have sold to many people. And then he will ask those to whom he weighed out honestly, and they will testify that they are not lacking. And they will contradict those who claim that he weighed out less. Okay? So I come and I say, I was cheated. And my handyman says, I don't know what you're talking about. I have 1,000,000 5-star reviews. All of these people can testify that I'm an honest laborer. And so even though he cheated you, because he hasn't cheated everybody, he's able to use his good reputation to attack your credibility. Because he's going to bring in all the people for whom he weighed out honestly, and they're going to testify on his behalf. And thereby the judge will resolve to say that it was diminished by you. The customers. For if this were not the case, why would you differ from these others who are not lacking anything? Doesn't make any sense. When he's going to sometimes be dishonest, that doesn't make any sense. Exactly. It worked because it doesn't make any sense. And when the court sends for his measure, and they're like, you know, okay, we're going to check, we're going to see how heavy is your measure, have you been cheating people? They're going to send for the measure, and guess which measure he's going to send? Not the small one, he's going to send the honest one. Of course, I always use this weight. Always exactly a pound. I've never weighed out less than a pound. Everybody who knows me knows that I always use this honest weight. And it turns out that were it not for the honest weight, he would not have been able to sell to all of them with the diminished one. And behold, this is why he holds on to the honest one, in order to validate his falsehood. And therefore, even the honest one is detested. We don't say about this guy, well, he only cheats his customers sometimes, so he's 50% a good salesman. We say he's a cheat, and he's using his honest transactions to paper over his dishonest transactions. So even his honest transactions are considered to be disgusting. It's strong language. And this is why it says those who do these, right, both of these, both weighing out falsely and weighing out not falsely, are detestable to God, regarding that he weighed with the honest ones. And this is also detestable because he only weighs with it in order to fool the world. All who do injustice, that is the false one. But even though the first one isn't unjust, it is still detestable. And regarding this, Shlomo said, they are alike, both detested, to include the honest one as well. Here is why I wanted to make sure that we saw this text. This person who's operating in the marketplace is exactly like Paro. His strategy is the same. He's not killing the female babies so that nobody will notice when he's killing the male babies. He's not weighing out honestly to you because sometimes he feels like being an honest guy. He's weighing out honestly for you because that corroborates his story. And so even when he weighs out honestly, he's actually doing probably worse, right, than when he's straight out lying. And what we have here is a kind of reversal of the notion of the ends justify the means. Right here we have the ends retroactively invalidating the means. Right, since what you have been doing, all of the honesty that you've been doing is for the sake of building up your reputation so that you can cover up and do something bad, then it becomes, after the fact, that every single honest thing that you've done has contributed to your dishonesty. And it has the effect of tainting everything that you've done. It's a high standard, right? It's harsh and it's relevant because we all do this. We all rely on our good reputation to allow us to do things that we probably wouldn't be able to do otherwise. I wouldn't even say this in necessarily a, you know, active bad way. I'll just speak sort of neutrally. The last time that I was pulled over for speeding, I just acted really sorry. I knew that I was speeding. But I also knew that I'm a small, white woman who doesn't make people think that she's a threat, even though I am a threat, but nobody knows that. Right? And I used the way that I look to get out of this ticket. And we all do this, right, in really subtle ways where we trade on our goodness. And the trick is to know when you're doing it, right, and to be careful that it doesn't come to sully all of the goodness that you've done. We want to read one more Kliyakar, and then I want to take some questions and some comments. I love this Kliyakar. I think that it's hilarious. He does not intend for it to be hilarious. He's actually furious. But sometimes when like you have some distance, you know, the thing that makes somebody else mad doesn't make you mad. The Kliyakar was actually very persecuted in his lifetime. And so his feelings about hypocrites are very strong. He feels that a lot of people in his environment are hypocrites. Okay, so now he's talking about non-kosher animals. Whenever the Torah describes non-kosher animals, first it tells you the kosher sign of the animal, and then it tells you, oh, but actually it's not really kosher because it doesn't chew its cud or it doesn't have split hooves. Right? It starts with why you might think the animal is kosher, and then says, sorry, it turns out it's not kosher in the end. Right? And this really bothers the Kliyakar. If the reason why the animal is not kosher is that it doesn't chew its cud, just say, you can't eat the rabbit, doesn't chew its cud. Don't say you can't eat the rabbit even though it has split hooves, it doesn't chew its cud. Who cares? It's very nice that you have split hooves. I'm proud of you, throw yourself a party. Why do I need to know that the rabbit has split hooves? It doesn't help me. And so the Kliyakar says, you're right. It doesn't help, makes it worse. Okay? It should have said because it doesn't have split hooves, because that is the reason for the impurity. Why does it begin with all of them, right? That is all of the animals, by mentioning their sign of purity. And the explanation of this idea is that the sign of purity in each of them adds impurity onto their impurity. Like they said about Esav, that he is compared to a pig. This is the part that I think is funny, but he does not intend to be funny. He extends his hooves to show that he is basically kosher, but his insides are full of bile and deception, right? You just sort of see this pig like sticking out its feet. It's like, no, I'm kosher, look. And then, thank you, but no thank you. Okay. But his insides are full of bile and deception. And this applies to anyone whose insides doesn't match their outside, like the character of the traitors, right? These are the people in this community he doesn't like, who show themselves off as kosher, and they are undoubtedly worse than the totally evil person whose inside and outside are equally bad. When your inside and your outside are equally bad, I know what I'm dealing with, right? And more importantly, when your inside and your outside are equally bad, you know what you're dealing with yourself. The way that this really, right, the way that this really manifests itself is that it's often hard for us to see our own signs of impurity because we're so blinded by our signs of purity. I really meant well. And so therefore, it's almost impossible for me to see that my well-meaning acts had a bad outcome. And if I had known that I didn't mean well, and if I had tried to do wrong, then that should be very easy for me to repent. I would see the whole process, and I would blame myself the whole way down. But because there's a mismatch between what my intentions are and what the results were, I can keep on saying to myself, but I meant well. I didn't intend to hurt that person, right? And this is the danger. The danger is in our allowing ourselves to focus on the parts of our reputation that are legitimately good, and then blinding ourselves to the ways in which our good character traits and our good behavior mask and enable the things that we do that are difficult, the things that we do that are destructive. This is the real warning of Paro, of the guy with the false weights, and this little piggy who sticks out its kosher hooves. Right, that we are all the piggy who stick out our kosher hooves. And it's not that the hooves aren't kosher. It's that we're being tricked. We're tricking ourselves by our own kosher hooves and not allowing ourselves to see the ways in which we're using our positive reputation to enable us to move, right, and to carry ourselves in ways we wouldn't otherwise. The last source that I want to read, and then I want to take your comments, and then we're going to close, is another favorite text of mine, of Rabbi Reuven, the son of Esterbili. When you first read this text, it seems a little exaggerated, it seems a little extreme, but I think that when you realize what he's trying to do with what he's saying, it actually becomes extremely relevant. He says, a person is only suspected of something if he has done it. So if I'm accused of robbery, I definitely, you know, stole that object. But then he says, well, if he hasn't done it entirely, he has done it in part. Okay, you weren't a robber, but maybe you drove the getaway car. And if he has not done it in part, and if it can't have been said about you that you were an abettor, he contemplated doing it. And if he did not contemplate it, then he saw others doing it, and he was pleased. Okay, right, and what is Rabbi Reuven, the son of Esterbili, really trying to say to you when he says that if you're suspected of something, you should consider yourself as if you've done it? Right, what he's trying to say to you is, nobody is above suspicion. And when somebody accuses you of something, your first response is always, how could you say something like that about somebody like me? I'm a good person. I always mean well. I give tzedakah. How could you accuse me of being a thief? And what Rabbi Reuven, the son of Esterbili, really is trying to get you to do is to strip away those layers. Because there is something in you that would be willing to do this. You have covered it over with all of your striving and with all of your success, and you are successful, right? It's not that you haven't deserved. You haven't earned the reputation that you have. But you have to not respond with, this is my great reputation. How could you possibly suspect me of doing something that's wrong? So I'd like, on this down note, to open up the floor for any questions or comments.
About when it's really bad to be a little good. Yes.
What would be the alternative way to get yourself in this last
defending? Right, so I think that Rabbi Reuven, the son of Esterbili, would say you're not supposed to defend yourself. You're supposed to ask yourself, what is it about me that made that person suspect me of this? There's something about the way that I carry myself, there's something about what I've been thinking that sort of opened up the possibility for someone to view me in this way. Instead of saying, that person is crazy for viewing me in this way, ask yourself, thanks for the feedback, right? What is it that that person has noticed about me that I'm not able to see about myself?
Because they clearly don't think that I'm above suspicion, and maybe I'm not. Yes, in the green shirt.
Yeah, so the question is, what's the difference between being a hypocrite and just a flat-out cheat? I think that part of the goal of this shiur is to understand that maybe those two categories aren't necessarily so easy to disentangle, and that the more hypocritical you are, the more successful you are going to be at being a cheat. And to ask yourself, in what ways am I doing myself and others a disservice? And what is it about me that enables that?
Yeah.
It seems like the role of tshuva is totally absent from the kli of har. So I'm just curious, does that ever come out in this, it's very blatant text that there's no element, and you brought up repentance, and I'm really more interested in the tshuva. Like, what is there any essence of that?
Yeah, so the Kli Yakar's goal is not to inspire you. I think the Kli Yakar's goal is to scare you, right? And to make you realize that there are all sorts of things that you're doing or that other people are doing, right? These, people are sticking out their hooves that are not what they appear. In answer to your question, I think that the real piece here that enables us to do tshuva is that we often think of tshuva as being a process of identifying the things that we've done wrong and then trying to fix those things.
This is asking you to do something else, which is to identify the things that you're doing right that you're using in an inappropriate way. Right? And so you can't actually stop at what are my bad traits. You also have to push further and ask, what are my good traits that I am not doing right by because I'm using these good traits and sort of turning them sour. Yeah.
Where this field
constructs,
so that the
social what?
Social constructs. So mm-hmm. if societal situations in context, right? Our engagement and our interactions so that when we see those who twist slightly succeed greatly, right? And then change to maintain a level of purity, right? That beast system demand, right? For lack of a better term, right? Creates a situation where holding on to that creates a possibility, right? Which isn't to say we should not strive for that, but it's with that, to a certain extent, it's without us, right? It's outside of us. We are in relation to greater forces that do reward. Car insurance goes up, right? When you get stopped, when you get the ticket, right? All these things happen, and everyone else is doing it, just to say that makes it right. But yet, that has become the norm, and we are squeezed into relating to that reality.
That's an excellent question. I'm not able, right, to tell you, well, here's how we're going to fix society and always reward the best behaviors, because society, right, is not set up to always reward the best behaviors, certainly not to reward the best spiritual behaviors. But I think that part of the lesson here, and maybe this could be applied in a larger way, goes back to my original question, why don't we just look at this as, well, this person is doing some component of good and some component of bad, that the sum of what you're doing, right, is not actually what you need to look at. What you need to look at is the way that it's arranged. Am I arranging my good acts so that they camouflage my bad acts? Right? Am I sort of strategically waiting until I'm good enough and then sort of lining up, you know, the advantages that I want to get behind that? And we could also do that kind of analysis, right, on a larger scale. Right, how are good and bad arranged in our society? What are the ways in which one enables the other? And if we were to decouple them, right, that's the goal. The goal is not to get rid of the good. I hope that that's clear. Right, the goal is to figure out how to decouple the good from the bad so that you're effectively able to salvage what's good about the good and dismantle and get rid of what's bad about the bad. When the two are together, you can't effectively address either. Because you're saying, well, I don't want to get rid of this bad thing in my life because so much of who I am in the good way is tied to it. So much of my gold is supported by this Yetzer Hara wood. So I can't just get rid of it. If I get rid of it, I'm going to crumble. And so part of the challenge here, and I use the term challenge very advisedly, this is not something that's easy to do, right? Part of the challenge here is to really try to purify and isolate the bad from the good, because I think that it enables us to really be able to treat both on their own terms and approach both with honesty. I'm going to close here. Thank you so much for joining us for this Yom Iyun, and Rev Eli has some closing thoughts for us.
Thanks for listening. To learn more with Hadar, please visit hadar.org/Torah.